from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There are plenty of reasons why reading a local newspaper is still a good idea, but here's one that doesn't always come to mind: keeping up on architecture and urban design. John King is the urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and since 2009, he's carved out a nice corner of the paper for his weekly cityscape column. It's spare, just a few photos and 100 or so words, but they capture some buildings or blocks worth noting, even if you've never noted them before. And now he's refurbished 50 of those columns and turned them into a hip pocket-sized book called Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. We'll talk with John King and get your nominees for buildings you love or hate next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. John King is the urban design writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he reports about urban development and architecture. And in a town where nearly every new building proposal is capable of sparking a decade-long debate, it can be a pretty lively beat. But John King is probably best known for his Cityscape column, where each week he depicts some interesting corner, building, or block of the city. Some are places you know, but more often than not, the column and accompanying photographs capture places you might have passed by 100 times without ever looking up. John King makes you want to look up, to pay attention to what's around you, to all the building blocks that combine to make the city the city. And now he's collected 50 of his columns in a new book called Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. And John King joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks. This is fun.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. One of the things you say in the introduction to your book that was striking to me, because I think it's so true, is that sometimes San Francisco architecture gets a bit lost, that we think so much of this being such a beautiful city because of the natural wonders of it and the land on which it sits and the bay and everything else, that we sort of think of the buildings as an afterthought. Come back at that sort of point of view.
No, it's interesting because if a big shot architect comes to town and you ask them, what do you like about San Francisco's architecture? The answer tends to be, I love the light, and it's really more the neighborhoods, how they all fit together. And both of those things are true, but I think that we tend to kind of dismiss the architecture of the city. It's like, I think for a lot of people would say the Victorians are great, the brick buildings of Jackson Square are great. You know, maybe we'll go all the way and say the 1920 skyscrapers are great. But everything since then, everything since the Golden Gate Bridge just has kind of eroded what made San Francisco distinct.
In that way, very unlike, for example, when you think about Chicago. When you go to Chicago, even though Lake Michigan is great and all the rest, you do really think quite readily about that particular skyline and those buildings.
Chicago exults in its architecture. I did a story ages ago about Chicago, and I talked with a leading preservationist there about the issue of tall buildings, which, you know, Chicago has the Sears Tower. They're no stranger to these things. And we were talking about how they had no compunction about fighting to save, we'll say, a little four-story building from 1880, but then allowing a 70-story tower next to it. And the architect's comment, the architect/preservationist, was, you know, we don't have hills and mountains. The skyline is our mountain range. You know, this total comfort with that, just like a total comfort with building up as you hit the lake, because it's just going to cast shadows on the water and it looks so dramatic, which is the polar opposite from San Francisco, where the whole thing is you don't want anything higher than 40 feet along the water. It violates the sanctity of the bay.
Does that then pose particular challenges for architects and architecture? Because we're also sort of, I mean, if Chicago's also sort of the ultimate grid city, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's laid out in a very geometric way. San Francisco is, in a way, the antithesis of that, which I would think also must present some challenges, because if you want a building to fit the space of which it's part, San Francisco's got a lot of jumbly spaces to try to fit into.
Part of what I love about San Francisco, and one reason I started doing this column, which I'll get to in a second, San Francisco has three or four grids that collide, and it has a topography that essentially repudiates the grid. Hmm. so you've got this interesting thing where a city like – if you go to Manhattan, you know, and you're coming on the shuttle from the airport, you can look straight through Manhattan. You know, you'll look down, say, 42nd Street, and you're looking through a 100-story tall cavern. San Francisco views always collide. I remember when I was a kid in college with a summer job in the financial district, and the hotel that's on Third Street between Mission and Market went up. It's like kind of a gray tombstone. It's been about four owners, which is teaches you not to build a bad building. But anyway, I remember it going up, and it blocked the view down Kearny, where I would walk out of my little bookstore where I worked to go get lunch. And it just infuriated me. You know, if that building had gone up on a city with one grid,
right,
it would have just disappeared. You know, so one of the reasons I started doing the column is that there's so many interesting things we confront if we just paused to look at the parts rather than the whole.
So it takes a little more work in a way in San Francisco.
Not so much work as much as just opening your eyes. And In terms of the design, it does take a lot of work because you're getting, you know, this city makes a fetish of context and every building has to fit the context. But realistically, there are about 9 different contexts for any site. There's a cultural context, there's the physical one, there's the architectural one, there's the social one. I mean, it's so simplistic to say there's one answer to everything, which is essentially it should look like its neighbor.
John King, our guest this morning, he writes the Cityscape column for the San Francisco Chronicle. A combination of them, a collection of those columns, has now been published in a new book called Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Building, which includes wonderful photographs, which you also took. All of the photographs in the book as part of the new way of being a reporter. You've also got to be a good photographer.
Not even that. I'm helped by the fact buildings don't move, so I can just use a point and shoot camera. It was the photo editor at the paper at the time had the idea. We kicked this column off in early 2009. Ward Bushy, the main editor at the paper, kind of got the idea that, you know, people here love buildings. They love the landscape. Could we do something on an ongoing basis that reflects that? And I'd been kicking around for a while the idea of honing in really super specific and just writing a few words about something, not a big essay. So I went out and took a dummy shot of 4 buildings. And the photo editor wasn't that impressed by what I shot, but she kind of said, you know, you're the one who want – you know exactly what you're looking for and what you're writing about. Why don't you shoot it? And so it's been a lot of fun. It's a kick in the pants. I definitely am learning my limitations, but it's fun.
Well, let's begin to work our way through some of the buildings you focus on in the book. And you're also quick to say that your book is not meant to be a complete collection of all of the noteworthy buildings in San Francisco. And we should note, by the way, that if you go to our website, if you go to kqed.org, that a number of the buildings that we're going to be talking about, we've posted pictures of them. So if you're not entirely sure what the Shell Building is, which I hope we can talk about in a bit, if you go to our website, you'll be able to find those pictures. And we welcome your thoughts, by the way, on buildings that you'd like to know more about or buildings that you love or hate. If you want to email us your favorite building or least favorite building over the course of our program, you can do that too at kqed.org. Let's talk about the first section of your book, John. Okay. Icons, it's called. And the very first building you focus on, I believe, is something that's become over time synonymous with San Francisco, and that's the Transamerica Tower. And it's also part of what you were talking about a moment ago, that all these contexts that a building has to contend with in the city. Take us back to the story that took place when that building was first proposed and what it had to contend with.
When the Transamerica Pyramid was proposed at, you know, where Montgomery Street meets Columbus Avenue, literally, there were protests about John Burton, never one to, you know, not be salty, talked about how it would rape the skyline. And you had every conceivable public group, including the San Francisco chapter of the American Institute of Architects, coming out about the building. It was too tall. Worse than that, it was too distinctive. If you were going to have an office building, it should not show off. And all of a sudden, at the time, at one point it was proposed to be 1,000 feet. It's only 853 feet. But it was proposed, here, what's this triangle doing popping up? It's ruining the skyline. It is tipping the whole city over. The financial district's going to invade North Beach and Telegraph Hill, so on and so forth.
An iconic part of the city.
Very much the iconic part of the city in terms of the whole, it's the neighborhoods and the light type of thing. The building exists because Mayor Joseph Alioto rammed it through. And he said all along, people are going to love this, blah, 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 blah. And almost as soon as it went up, opinion started to change. You can still, I personally don't think it's a great building. I think, though, it really works in its setting. And part of it is the grid thing we were talking about. I did a large article in late 2009 about how opinions about the pyramid changed between the time it was proposed in 69 and how it is today. And a fascinating thing to me is that in all the debate at the time, no one talked about, including the architects, talked about how the building would read in contrast to Columbus Avenue. And what I love about the building is you got this diagonal, which disrupts the grid, slicing down Columbus. It hits the pyramid and it continues up into the heavens. Hmm. It's just like one of these unplanned, unexpected things that creates such drama. If you had the same amount of square foot, if you had the same amount of space in a building that was 30 stories tall and just a rectangle, it would be a deadly building. It's better to have it twice as tall with this unimaginable flourish.
John King, again, our guest this hour, his new book, Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. If you want to pose a question about buildings in San Francisco, we'll open up our phone lines in 10 minutes or so, but you can email us a question now at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comment there. And also, a number of the buildings that we're talking about, you'll see pictures of them as we move throughout our discussion this morning. Let's talk about another one in your icon section, which is the Contemporary Jewish Museum, which in some ways is an attempt to combine, right, mm-hmm. old and new,
right,
in San Francisco.
Yeah, the concepts by – well, I shouldn't say the concept. The designs by Daniel Libeskind, who went on to – well, or had already designed the Jewish Museum in Berlin. It's very interesting. You've got an old substation, a brick substation designed by Willis Polk back around the time of the earthquake. And then the museum moved into it, and the new space is contained in these kind of jagged forms clad in sandy blue metal. And what I love about it, it's such an abrupt juxtaposition, but it's this real startling thing. The metal is extremely alive. If you walk down Mission Street from 3rd Street and just look at it as you walk, it's so cool how in about 20 steps, the whole texture and tone can change. It's this gorgeous metal. But then also, instead of it jarring with the brick build, with the brick structure, or overwhelming it or clashing, it shows you how good the brickwork is. So you've got this robust brick with these gorgeous, you know, goofy angels and babes and everything.
Built when, John?
1908. And okay. So it's got all
right
this fancy molding, even though it's, you know, was a substation, and the stuff was all cleaned up as part of it. So you just cherubs. So you've got kind of blue steel against white cherubs and red brick, and it's just – it's a fun building to look at.
You wrote earlier this week about the sort of perennial debate in San Francisco over historic preservation and whether or not we're cast too broad a net, that we make it too difficult for people who want to either build something adjacent or including an old building or revise it in some ways. Is this an example of getting the best of both?
I think it is. I know people who would disagree with me, who would say that the old building was treated too cavalierly. I think where San Francisco kind of tends to err is there is such a protectionist mentality among some of the people who love it that there's an idea that no change can be for the better. And my feeling is this is a dynamic city. It's a uniquely dense, uniquely situated metropolis. And the fact that it has these ongoing streams of culture and business and all sorts of economic, class, ethnic mixes going on, I think that having a certain friction in the built city as well conveys that, and it can make it fun. You don't want to overwhelm the old, but at the same time, you don't want to just kind of dumb everything down to 1937. I mean, that it's a tricky balancing act.
And you've also written that part of what makes a city interesting and visually stimulating is the continuous addition of new layers.
Absolutely.
That if you freeze things in time, you stop. You don't continue to grow.
Absolutely. I mean, people are absolutely right to be protective of the city. And if you tear away the old, you do lose too much. There's a large urban redevelopment area, which I've never written about, but I keep meaning to, the Golden Gateway Center, which is just north of the Embarcadero Center. And it is a remarkable example of early 1960s urban renewal thinking. Yeah, Sidney Walton Square is kind of the centerpiece of it. The old black steel Alcoa building is a high rise in it. And it's just perfectly done by 1960s thing. You get people off the street. You want quiet. You want houses. But there's no reason to go there. No one ever says, hey, let's go over and see what's happening in Golden Gateway today. It's just like this kind of static part of the city.
Let's go ahead and start taking calls. We weren't going to do it for a bit, but people are eager to talk about this topic. And we have a caller who's already lined up right now who wants to talk, I think, about this particular building. Paul is joining us from Vallejo. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, that's very funny that you should mention the Golden Gateway Center, because I'm a native San Franciscan, 75 years, and that's one of the buildings, sites that I love. I remember when it was built, and I thought how nice that you could walk up off the street, and there's mm-hmm. a fountain up there, and there's living above, there's commercial shops below, and it was such a wonderful concept. Architecturally, I'm not sure that it's a masterpiece, but the concept I thought was really beautiful.
Paul, thank you.
Well, that's what I mean. It's so well done for what the thinking was at the time. I love the Alcoa building. When I was growing up in Walnut Creek and our family would drive over the Bay Bridge to go see the Giants or whatever, in retrospect, that was kind of a sign of where I was heading, because I looked at it and I thought, what a cool black box facing the water. But it's fascinating because you're right. It's all set. That was the idea at the time. You don't want cars and people to mix, so you just elevate people off the street, and you have walkways cutting over, and you've got little townhouses sprinkled through it. By all accounts, it's a great place to live. But there is this kind of static thing. It's always the same. And part of the allure of a city like San Francisco is that it keeps changing in terms of what's hot, what isn't, so on and so forth. So that's why I love the Golden Gateway. It's almost like, just as a scholarly resource, it's fascinating.
Let's talk, though, about one building that remains largely preserved and unchanged. I want to talk about it in part because it's a favorite of mine, and that's the Shell Building in downtown. Mm-hmm. Describe it. Again, there's a picture of it on our website. If you go to kqed.org/forum, you can see a picture of the Shell Building if you're not familiar with it. But I think it's just a little jewel of a building.
The Shell Building is one of about half a dozen really terrific towers that went up in the 1920s boom. I mean, every skyline is marked by economic booms, and by the time the towers go up, the boom has gone bust. But the Shell Building was designed by George Kellam, who was a New York architect who moved here as a young architect after the 1906 earthquake. A lot of business here. And it is about 30, 35 stories, wrapped in this gorgeous sandy terracotta that is, you just want to touch it when you walk by. I love the building. And it's classic 20s. It's got this big arched entryway with a elaborate metalwork and elaborate carvings around the arched entrance. And then it just shoots straight up from the street and it just grabs its place and it says, I'm 1920s, I'm proud. In a few years, Superman's going to be flying off the top of me. And of course, it has, you know, ornamental shells at the top. What more do you want?
Shell Building, one of the buildings featured in the first part of John's book, the icon section of the book, again called Cityscapes, San Francisco and its Building. Let me ask you about one more building that's featured in that section before we move on and we open up our conversation further to our listener comments and calls. And that's the Federal Building, the new Federal Building, because it is not one that people love, generally speaking. I'm curious about why you wanted to include it in your book. And what'd you think of it? This is the book that some people call The Flying Nun. I mean, it goes by lots of different names. Describe it.
Oh, I hadn't heard The Flying Nun. The San Francisco Federal Building was designed by Tom Main. His firm is Morphosis, or as they say, Morphosis. You got to be cool, in Santa Monica. And Main is one, probably next to Frank Gehry, is the most influential architect from the Los Angeles area. And he's all about this kind of Blade Runner metal, confrontational, slash-and-burn type architecture style. So the Federal Building is this, I think, 210-foot tall, but like 180-foot long slab that's pretty thin, only about 65 feet to allow for natural ventilation. And the side facing the sun is clad in perforated steel panels that are supposed to open and shut to let light in when the sun's not coming through directly. But the idea is a sustainable building. But then with Tom Main, it's kind of sustainability with this real edginess. And I love the fact it's there. I don't love the building. I like the building. I find the building really exciting. I have problems with it, but it's almost like a rhetorical statement. But it's also an interesting building because it's a real confrontational building. But it's at 7th and Mission Street, which is not a part of town that anyone really takes as their turf. So I know a lot of people who love the building, and I know a lot of people who hate the building, but it's not one that just comes up in conversation like the De Young or the Tower by the Bay Bridge when Rincon is just things that people go, oh my God, how did that happen? The Federal Building, it's funny. It's just people who know the city have their own habits, including me, of how they look at it. And so if something provocative goes up in your direct line of sight, you react to it. If something provocative goes up a few blocks away, it just kind of settles into the landscape. There are buildings I've written pretty savage things about, including a tower that went up perpendicular to this Federal Building, that I've even said in the piece, if this building were three blocks away, it wouldn't stand out. It's just, in this case, you've got the Federal Building, which is this kind of metal Blade Runner thing, and the next to it, you've just got your classic stucco condo box.
John King, again, the book Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. We're coming up on a short break, so we'll take our calls after we return. Here's the number if you want to join us. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us your questions, buildings you love, buildings you hate, buildings you're just wondering about at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, add your comments there, and there are also pictures there of the Shell Building we were just describing, as well as the Contemporary Jewish Museum, the Federal Building, a variety of others, Transamerica Tower, all the rest, and the buildings we're going to be talking about in just a moment. And we'll take your questions, too. We've already got some questions. When we come back, John, we're going to talk about One Rincon Hill, which one listener describes as being the devil's finger. So we'll get your thoughts on it and a variety of others when we continue. Again, here are the numbers, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. More with John King and Cityscapes in just a moment. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. John King is our guest this hour. He is the columnist of the Cityscape and photographer for that column, Cityscape column that appears weekly. What day of the week, John, is it? That's
Sundays in the Bay Area section.
Sundays in the Chronicle.
At a newsstand near you.
And they've been collected now in a new pocket-sized book, Cityscape, San Francisco and Its Buildings. I like the size of this, by the way. It's very handy to be able to kind of stuff.
We designed it for the coat pocket, not the coffee table.
Right. No, it's great in that way. If you want to join us, ask John about buildings you like or buildings you hate or buildings you have questions about. Again, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Lots of questions coming in. We're going to do our best to talk about a bunch of them and get to some of the other buildings that you note in your book. Some questions came into us from our public insight network, and you can share your experiences with the network and help shape future episodes of Forum, by the way. You can learn more about the Public Insight Network by going to kqednews.org/public insight. Some of the questions that have been posted on our Public Insight Network, I want to get to one right away because you referenced One Rincon Hill. Brooke writes in, how was One Rincon Hill allowed to be built? I can't imagine a building of that height going unchallenged in San Francisco. It's creepy. When I was working in SoMa, I realized it would suddenly be there peering down at me almost no matter where I was. It's like it's spying on you. It's like the Eye of Mordor. My husband calls it the Devil's Finger. Brooke doesn't like One Rincon Hill.
Well, it's funny because I could go into planning things. I've written about planning a lot over the years. And before I was our urban design critic, I did a stint as our planning reporter. We wrote a number of articles about the city planning effort, which is raise heights on Rincon Hill to allow a lot of slender, tall residential towers.
And before you go further, sure. John, just to locate people who aren't that familiar with the city, it's right by the Bay Bridge as you're traveling east.
Yeah, this is the tower that's right by the Bay Bridge as you drive in, the one you go, oh my gosh, where did that come from? And this is the area that used to be ensnarled in off-ramps to the Embarcadero Freeway, which, of course, disappeared in 89. The ramps disappeared in the mid-90s. This area that had been off the map suddenly was in the line of development. One Rincon is where the old Union 76 tower used to be, which was, you know, anyway. So the planning theory was San Francisco needs to make room for more people to live in the next 10, 20, 30 years. Why don't we raise heights south of the financial district, allow slender towers, space them out, so on and so forth, and people will live there, they'll walk to work, so on and so forth. One Rincon is the tallest one that will be allowed down there. It's also the southernmost one. And it's the one that got built first, and then the whole real estate market tanked. Mm. So you've got One Rincon, like this big flagpole stuck on the top of a hill, and then you've just got empty blocks. Theoretically, it's the summit, and over the next few years, there's this kind of slope downward of towers leading into the financial district. But that could be a while.
Though Brooke and many others are unhappy about the way it sticks out, mm-hmm. the way it does, you could also, I guess, make the argument that San Francisco doesn't have the most exciting skyline in the world.
Right.
It's pretty flat. And this at least allows a punctuation mark.
Well, that's the idea. Theoretically, this is the accent that sets off the new residential skyline. The oddity of it is that it popped up before anything else came along.
So it's an exclamation point without a sentence.
Exactly. I'm going to plug my Twitter site, John King SF Cron, because last year for about 9 months, I did a little thing on Twitter. If it's Monday, it must be One Rincon. Because I'm like Brooke. I started realizing it was everywhere. And the first time I took a picture was when I was up in the observation deck of the De Young building, the De Young Museum. And I realized I could see One Rincon out of it. And it was like, oh, my gosh.
Funny you should mention the De Young. Ted in San Francisco wants to talk about the De Young as well. Ted, go ahead, please.
Hi there. Thank you. Hi, John. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the De Young Museum. It's one of my favorite buildings in the whole world because of its hidden secrets, how you can walk around it and the tower looks like a pyramid from one area, and from other areas it looks like an upside-down pyramid. What are your thoughts?
I love the De Young Museum. I think it's the best new building we've gotten since I started writing about this in 2001. And part of what I love about it is the type of thing you're talking about. It's such an alive building. It is not a static building. And the tower's something. There are angles of the tower I don't like where it looks too much like this big wide slab. Then you walk a bit further or you just hit it from another angle and it's the most slender thing. And also it's a wonderful building inside to experience. You don't have to buy a ticket and you can really explore a good bit of the museum and then go up in the tower and get a truly unique view of the city.
De Young is one of the buildings that is included in John's book, by the way. It's in the section that's titled Styles and Masters. What are the other buildings you hear the most about? I mean, what are the buildings that people sort of love to hate? If it's one Rincon, De Young, I'm sure, gets a lot of very mixed reactions still, even now in this part of its tenure in Golden Gate Park. What else do people sort of...
The De Young definitely sticks out. A lot of people just resent so much that it's there. Usually these things kind of fade. Mm. For instance, the Hotel Vitale, which is down at the foot of Market Street, people hated it when it got built, me included. I think it's a terrible building. I think it kind of stands in for the failure of San Francisco planning and architecture at times. But it's not big enough. It's kind of now just settled into place. One Rincon is so visible that a lot of people react to that. In the 60s, it was the Jack Tar Hotel, which is now going to be torn down for a hospital if that ever gets built. There's a big chunky federal building near City Hall and the Civic Center that really is horrible. It's funny, though. Lately, I don't hear as much. Maybe it's because we haven't had any new buildings for a few years.
And more of our calls wanting to know about John King's thoughts on various buildings, including a bank, it sounds like. Rebecca has that question from St. Helena. Rebecca, go ahead, please.
Oh, hello. Good morning. I love your show. One of my favorite buildings in San Francisco, it's the Chase Bank on the corner of Van Ness and Lombard Street. It has these incredible stained glass windows and a mural inside, and I've always wondered what it used to be, and so I hope you could tell me more about it. It's an incredible building.
Rebecca, thanks. John is looking very perplexed.
Rebecca, this is why I love writing about what I do and writing about it in an area like this. People are always asking me about buildings that I don't know. I've never noticed that. Maybe it's because I live in the East Bay and I tend to take BART to work. So this is drawing a complete blank, but next time on Van Ness, I'll be checking out the Chase around Broadway.
Van Ness and Lombard, Rebecca?
Or Lombard.
It's on the corner of Van Ness and Lombard. From the outside, you wouldn't notice it at all, but you go inside, and it's this beautiful 20s-looking building. It has an incredible stained glass window and a mural of the story of California.
Wow. All right. Well, great lead, Rebecca. John may well write a cityscape column about it in the future. So sorry
Sounds
we couldn't
cool.
provide more information, but thanks for the thought and the suggestions. Here's some of the emails coming in. I hate the new federal building on 7th Street. I applaud the sustainability, but it comes at a price. It's interesting. Do they have to go hand in hand?
I don't think so. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the building is how aggressively it uses sustainability. It kind of argues you can have sustainability and cutting edge, but you can also have sustainability just by being diligent and careful about how you build. I mean, for instance, one of the larger firms in town is EHDD Architecture. They do, net zero carbon buildings, things like that, schools and things. There's no flash in what they do. They're just good, diligent, really creative, but very moderated architects. You don't have to have flash.
Here's someone else who wants to ask, in a way, a question about sustainability. John King talked about the sanctity of the bay. Why isn't there more outrage about the 45-story tower proposed for Treasure Island? A lot of the Treasure Island development, mm-hmm. hotly debated, but there is a real effort being made by the planners of that project for sustainability
right.
and the way in which it's organized and designed and all the rest. What's your take on where that's going?
I think Treasure Island's fascinating. That began as a much smaller project, and then it was environmentalists who actually pushed to more than double the amount of housing there. Their argument was, if you're going to put anything on Treasure Island in terms of rebuilding the Navy base, you've got to have enough people living there to sustain stores, to sustain a ferry service, to generate money to buy new buses, like commute buses, so on and so forth. You need a real dense community there, albeit with a lot of redone open space. Architecturally, at one point, that included a tower that was 650 feet tall. And I was going to write a piece about how that was just too tall. And then because of some complaints from some people on Telegraph Hill and other things, they lowered it down to 450 feet. So the tower will not be as tall as the Bay Bridge towers.
Do we have too much of a fetish about height in San Francisco? I mean, is it more worry than we should on that front?
Well, it depends on the location. I think we do in the sense that something is sinful if it's above 80 feet or 150 feet or 250 feet. That said, I don't think, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area enough that I'm not of the Chicago school that, you know, why not just pop something 1,000 feet high next to a, you know, one-story high hut.
Brian in San Francisco writes, praise of architecture is great, but what about the architectural hall of shame? Some architects and their insulated professional culture have been bad for San Francisco. What do you think of the Bank of America Tower? You actually include that in your book. No?
No.
Oh, I'm mixing it up with 101 California,
yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
No, Bank of America building, which is the second tallest, I think it's 790 feet, I can find you architects who will say it's the best building on the skyline. I think it's a little too dark and heavy and things like that. You know, back in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, the architectural thinking was we're going to solve the problems. And that led to a lot of the problems that we have today. You know, you have a lot of big, bad buildings that kind of kill street life.
Here's a question about a building someone really likes, which is, my favorite building is the Cathedral of St. Mary the Assumption, otherwise known as Our Lady of the Maytag.
I like that for
its resemblance to a washing machine agitator. I love how this huge building that is also somehow a fantastically light, bright, and airy spot in the city.
That was my cityscape last Sunday. So go to www.sfgate.com. I think St. Mary's is fascinating. It's not in the book because I just did it, but it is such an icon. And it's so, you know, you're down on Valencia Street, you know, the epicenter of hipsterdom. And you look up from Boogaloo's Cafe or something like that. And here's this thing that's off in the distance, and it's St. Mary's. It's something how dominant it is on that part of the city.
And let's take a call. Michael joins us next. Michael, go ahead. Oh, sorry, I jumped to Adrian in Mountain View. Adrian, go ahead.
Hi there. I lived in the city for 30 years, and the Cliff House used to be a great place with the Mechanical Museum, and then they had a chance to rebuild it, and they turned it into a pump station. And it used to be so regal and such a great building. I had a chance. But, I mean, I can see it's next to the ocean, maybe the wind and everything. But what's your take on what they made it?
Yeah, Adrian, you're making me feel guilty because I should have written about it. I was real disappointed by it. And one of these things you kind of don't write where it was just – I mean, it's one of these things where it's tricky the job I do because there's a certain – I want pieces to relate to wider readerships. So if I review a gas station in San Ramon, there's got to be a reason so that someone who hasn't seen it will relate. And with the Cliff House, I totally agree with Adrian. I think it was kind of this space that it's such an unusual setting. And what got done there is very pedestrian, and they even kind of bollocked up the views inside. Having said that, for whatever reason, and I think I may have been wrong, when it opened at the time, I couldn't really come up with something other than, boy, this is too bad. There wasn't a larger moral to the story.
Here's another question that came in on our Public Insight network about the Emporium Dome. Barbara writes in, why did Westfield Mall decide to obscure the historic Emporium Dome from ground floor viewers? They did a beautiful job of restoring the dome, but it should have functioned as an incredible gem in the heart of that space.
That was a trade-off at the time where Westfield made the case that we need to lift the dome up so we can insert shops under it, but it'll still be the finale to our indoor mall. I mean, you can definitely – and this was all before I started doing what I do. I kind of came in about the time construction started. I mean, I think you can definitely quibble. One thing – about it is that it was designed in such a way that if you walk in, theoretically, when you walk in the front door off Market Street, you could look up and see the dome, which is beautifully restored. However, the design allows it, but Westfield jammed all, you know, so the whole cut that's left open, Westfield jammed it with all these little kiosks and cubicles to peddle, you know, perfume and foreign language tapes and things like that, because they see a sight line and they want to fill the sight line with product. I mean, that's one of the problems in the world is architects design things with this kind of crossed finger thing that their clients won't then try to make money out of it.
Reminds me a bit of the old Frank Lloyd Wright story about he wanted to design everything in any client's house, furniture, everything, because he didn't trust the clients.
Right.
He wanted it to be exactly the way he wanted
Very
it.
Very few not... architects have that clout.
By the way, John does reference within a book a lovely little Frank Lloyd Wright building in the city, the one on Maiden Lane.
140 Maiden Lane. It's a terrific building. It kind of takes his brickwork from when he was a young buck and no one had ever heard of him. And then the interiors got the Guggenheim Museum swirl a decade before he did the Guggenheim.
And to Paul in Livermore. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. Say, this is not a very interesting architecturally building. It's on the corner of Bush and Dashiell Hammett Way, which is kind of an alley that goes from, I think, California down to Bush. Anyway, Moss's restaurant is there, and I would take my lettuce there and sell it to him. Then I'd have to go once a month up to get the check. And in the business office on the 8th floor this is the most beautiful ceiling I've ever seen. It's oval. In two dimensions, oval stained glass window.
Paul, thanks. John?
8th floor above Masa's. Everyone, I'll meet you there.
Yet another place.
I didn't know. This is great.
Another place that John's going to explore. Other comments coming in from our website. One person writes, the De Young reminds me of Auschwitz. I can hardly bear to look at it. Inside, it's wonderful. But the lobby is too small. Well, there you go on what people think of the De Young.
You know, there are out-of-town architecture critics who don't like the lobby. And I think that what I like about the lobby is the quiet of it. It's like this neat little pinwheel that everything spins off of.
Couple of comments coming in about Mission Bay. Eric writes in, I'm curious about your thoughts on the UCSF Mission Bay development. For me, this is fast becoming one of the most inhospitable spots in the city. It feels like San Jose, plunked down in the midst of San Francisco. Ooh, 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 ooh. And Susan in Berkeley wants to talk about that as well. Susan, Mission Bay?
Yes, hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I just wonder what John King thinks about that development. It seems like it was, a place where something really nice could have been built on that side of the city. Instead, when you drive by all these buildings, all you can see is, like, humongous, like, windows, you know, these green glass windows. And I just wonder if Mr. King knows of a building that is worth looking at.
Susan?
Yeah. Mission Bay took shape in the 80s and early 90s when San Francisco, I think, was at the height of its let's plan things so prescriptively that nothing bad can happen. And what you get are these incredible straitjackets that then when everything gets built, it's just kind of mediocre. And I think Mission Bay suffered from that. In terms of what's neat there, I think the saving grace of the Mission Bay neighborhood in the long run is going to be the open space is well planned. And if you go down there right now, McCovey Cove is where the ballpark is. There is a park along the creek that comes in. And if you walk to the end of the creek, it's about 3 or 4 blocks long, you come to this little kayak shed that's like a kind of blue fiberglass teepee. And that's probably the coolest little building in Mission Bay. So that's what you can go find. And it's in this really cool park that's underneath freeway ramps. It's one of the great surprises of the city.
If you want to see a picture, by the way, of the kayak house, it is on our website. If you go to kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, you'll see a picture of the kayak house. It's one of the buildings that's also featured in John's book. Gaston writes in an interesting observation. He writes, to me, the rescue of the Embarcadero after the freeway was taken down, including the ballpark and the ferry building, and the Golden Gate Park Concourse, New Academy of Sciences in DeYoung, are two of the best things that have happened to the city. What to you, Gesson wants to know, are the best things that have happened in recent years?
I think those are actually good ones. I mean, it's funny about the Embarcadero. This gets back to the 80s. There was a public vote about tearing down the Embarcadero freeway in the mid-80s, and it failed because of fears that if you took down the Embarcadero, there would be development and those evil developers would screw things up. Literally, there was a public referendum. Herb Cain was against it. Everybody was against it.
And if Herb Cain was against it.
There we go. Anyway, I think, honestly, I think what you're describing is true. I think one of the other really good things that has happened in recent years, there's been a real attention to little things like sidewalks, alleyways, squares. If you go south of Market Street, I mean, Yerba Buena Garden is terrific. Not so much for the architecture of any one piece, like around where SF MoMA is. But after a lot of urban renewal mistakes in the early 60s, what has taken shape there is a remarkable new neighborhood. But if you go over to like 1st, 2nd Street, that area, partly because of students and things like that, there's a real interesting culture that's emerged.
John King, again, our guest this hour, the book Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. And continuing now with more of our questions and comments, here's one, and you'll know which building this person is talking about. How did the jukebox ever get through planning? Referring, of course, to
the Marriott Jukebox, my least favorite big building in San Francisco. My own hall of shame starts with the Marriott Jukebox. Before my time, thank goodness, it was done by redevelopment, not planning, which anyone in the planning department of the era apparently would have, you know. I don't know. It's there. It spends off a lot of money, does a lot of business, and a lot of people like it, including my date book editor. They're big fans of it. So who am I to say?
Where else would you suggest people explore the city? There's so many iconic places in the city. If you start with Telegraph Hill, and you reference the Malik Apartments in your book on Telegraph Hill, but where else? You're talking about, you know, the 1st and 2nd Street area. Where would you send people out wandering to sort of see a part of the city that isn't necessarily part of what we commonly think of what San Francisco looks like?
Right, that's a good distinction. I really do think that if you explore, and it's too bad that Interstate 80 is in the way, but I do think if you kind of head down the Embarcadero, explore the South Park area between 2nd and 3rd Street, if you just kind of poke around some of the alleys around SF MoMA, that area has really changed in some interesting ways. I think that for just kind of the grain of the city, a place like the Inner Sunset taps into a lot of the different pieces of why, you know, no one piece of it's stunning, but the whole is compelling. This is becoming an obvious thing, but you know, there's no urban experience to compare with the walk along Crissy Field in the Presidio. You know, it's tricky because a lot of San Francisco is the timeless appeal. Just super quick, I know we're coming toward the end. Craig Dykers is one of the principals of the firm Snohetta, which is designing the extension to SF MoMA that'll be, and the image is supposed to be released later this month. And he and I were talking. And he was telling me his favorite part of San Francisco, where he just really thought it was so cool, was Grant Avenue at Green Street. And I would, you know, it's kind of like, well, yeah. And to him, it's like he had discovered this new world.
Cecile in Berkeley has a question. Go ahead, Cecile.
Hi. Well, I'm so glad you mentioned Snohetta Group, because I feel that, you know, politically, the Bay Area is so liberal. But in architecture, it hasn't been. And so I'm so excited about Snohetta and about the Berkeley Museum having Diller and Scofidio. And I would say that it would be wonderful to promote that. I just want to mention that I took a wonderful class on lectures in architecture given by an Italian architect here in the Bay Area. And he talked about, for example, the fact that with all the wealth in Silicon Valley, There's not one building of note. So we need people like yourself to promote really fine contemporary architecture.
Cecile, thanks.
That's yeah. our cultural heritage.
Thank you.
Honestly, I would say that a lot of minds will not be changed. I've written very assertive. I think, you know, a lot of this stuff is really exciting, and I've said so in print, but it definitely, there are some people who will not be swayed.
And one last question comes from John, who writes, it seems like New York or Chicago are considered attractive because of their architecture. San Francisco is attractive despite of its architecture. Do you agree?
Well, that kind of gets back to the book. I think we kind of get a bad rap. There's a lot of good work here. The difference between this place and places like that is that the architecture isn't the reason for being. It's more that it contributes to the fabric. And again, I think we give ourselves too hard a rap. We can be too hard on ourselves. But we're not – it ain't the loop in Chicago. But, you know, Chicago, a lot of people in Chicago love to come to San Francisco.
We've given you a couple of assignments from this program, the bank somewhere around Venice and Lombard, and another couple of suggestions as well. What else are you going to be writing about soon? What can people, your readers in the Chronicle, look forward to in terms of future cityscape possibilities?
Oh, boy, cityscape. I've got a good one about how do you design for context, which is a 60s solution that I don't know if I like it, but it's fascinating to look at. And I'm working at a big piece on big hospitals, which are definitely changing the urban terrain throughout the Bay Area.
John King, again, has been our guest. If you'd like to see some of the pictures and buildings that we've been talking about, you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum. You can see many of the pictures that John has been speaking about on our site. Again, his building is called, or his book, rather, is called Cityscapes, San Francisco and Its Buildings. John, really a pleasure to have you on this morning.
My pleasure, too.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer today. Go, Danny. Good luck with the run tomorrow. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.